And now, a presentation on the Mental Health News Radio Network. The Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show.
Ryan, that is a freaking awesome question.
You are the power, and you do not need anybody's permission.
He's the only guy that ever crawled out of a grave where people didn't go, oh, ah!
Don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride.
You're a great interviewer. You're one of the best.
If this is the best God can do, I am not impressed.
It is a blessing and a profound honor to welcome our featured guests. This is an individual who was the voice of reason, who kept so many people grounded when the whole world went insane the past couple of years. His name is Del Bigtree. He is a passionate advocate for health choice, health advocacy. He's got a phenomenal show called The High Wire, which you can go to, called thehighwire.com. Also, you can check out his other website, icandecide.org. Mr. Bigtree, thank you so much, and thank you for all that you have done for the greater good of humanity.
Well, thank you, Ryan, and thanks for having me on today.
Thank you. So the first thing I want to ask is, there was a point when I felt that the tide was shifting, when people were fully waking up and realizing everything about COVID and the vaccines. And I think that your event that you did in DC with JP Sears, I felt like that was the turning point, because there was something around there, their energy and shift. Do you feel that that was a turning point? And when do you believe that public consciousness eventually shifted in favor of freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that event in Washington, D.C., the Defeat the Mandates event, which I think had about 45,000 people gathered there in front of the Lincoln Memorial. I remember standing, we had all sort of started, across at the monument, across the water, and then, walked over to the side where Lincoln's at. And when I stood up on those stairs and looked back, and all you saw was just, as far as you could see, there was these just lanes of people just pouring in around the stage. And I remember thinking in that moment, we are finally here. And for me, that was a journey that didn't start at the beginning of COVID, but really started when I released the documentary Vax, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, that threw me in the middle of this vaccine conversation. That released in April of 2016. So to be standing there, in the middle of COVID and just realize this was the type of event we were dreaming could happen, that sort of 1960s style. And I say that because I grew up with my parents who were hippies that marched in Chicago, and the footage of those anti-war protests. So when I got involved in this, I thought, what will that moment feel like? And I do think that was a really big turning point, certainly in the middle of COVID. I want to add in there was an event prior to COVID in New Jersey that we call the Battle of Trenton, where right before COVID, they were trying to remove their religious exemption, their ability to opt out of the vaccine program. That had, I think, over 10,000 people outside of the state capitol all day. We sang chants. And inside the state capitol there, they were trying to get one vote. And we just were so loud and filling that state capitol. But at that moment, the turning point was, it was the first time we saw politicians coming out of the capitol and stumping to this audience of, what used to be called anti-vaxxers. And that's really the shift you see when you start realizing that you're no longer seen as a pariah any longer, but being recognized that you are a large group of people with a value system that can be appealed to. When you start seeing the politics move in your direction, that is certainly the moment that you know that this entire conversation has changed. So I just want to put that out there, because I think a lot of people are only seeing this through the eyes of COVID. I think that march in New Jersey was huge, but certainly I think the world became aware of us. That was sort of a state's issue. The world became aware of us and the size and power of this movement in Washington, D.C.
Well, it was amazing. I know that I felt that when I was listening to your shows and watching it, the people that you were having on, I could feel the momentum shifting. And I thought J.P. Sears was his comedic talents were adding things, but you were also having people on every week that were always adding, pushing the football down. And I was so amazed at how such a small number of people were so determined. And it was just beautiful to see it happening. Before we go on a little bit further about the COVID war, I want to come back a little bit to your previous experience. I mean, you used to be a producer on The Doctors. What was your reason why you decided to take on the chance to start speaking out, to start going on a path that not many people have gone on before? What was the turning point for you? And why did you feel that you had to take the action that you did?
Well, I mean, there's multiple ways to answer that question. To begin with, it goes back to how I was raised. I had really forward-thinking parents that took parenting very seriously. My father was a dynamic minister. And, you know, in our family, we were raised to not only tell the truth, but actually, you know, be involved in helping the world evolve to being better people, to be better people ourselves. And so when I was leaving for Hollywood, you know, my father, I think, would have preferred I stayed and, you know, take over the family church. But he said to me, just, you know, Hollywood tends to defile the human spirit. Raise us up, Dale, raise us up. And that's something that I always sort of held on to through the work that I did. You know, I worked for the Dr. Phil show before I got onto the Doctor's television show, and people can have their opinions, but I always tried to make the work that I did in there as a producer, that we still, you know, told stories that I think, you know, tried to help elevate humanity. The Doctors is an incredible opportunity to get to do that on CBS. And of course, I won an Emmy Award for that work along with the other production team. So my career was doing just fine before I decided to get involved with one of the most controversial issues the world has ever seen. And when you look at the amount of pharmaceutical sponsors in television, it's the number one sponsorship body you have. Yeah. It doesn't even matter. I mean, on a medical talk show, it was almost all medical sponsors, but even the news, CNN, you know, all of these channels, CBS, when you watch those ads, you realize that about 70% of the advertising is pharma. So if you decide to make a documentary like I did, which was called Vaxxed, about, you know, the harms and potential harms of vaccination, in that case, specifically the MMR vaccine, its connection to autism, you know, you are probably letting go of that television career. But I will say, you know, this gets represented. I know a lot of people always say, thank you for your sacrifice, but it was the easiest decision I've ever made.
Awesome.
It was something that in my soul, I had always felt like there was a story that was going to be told that I needed to tell, and I just hadn't found it yet. So I could even say, as a journalist, when you stumble on something that had as much, as many facts and as many pieces of truth, and I had a whistleblower inside the CDC at the heart of that story. I just was surprised. I was the only journalist in the world telling it, you know, and I think every journalist looks for, you know, their sort of Woodward and Bernstein moment. And it was clear to me that that's what I was going to be able to bring to this conversation. And so it had a lot of things to it. Number one, the truth was there. I recognize that if, you know, it's one of those, if not me, then who? And if not now, when? All of the information all came together in that film, and there was just no way I could turn away from it. And I remember talking to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who had already been working on it for about a year and a half, and if people don't know who he is, you know, probably the most controversial medical figure in the world today. But I just kept saying to him, are you sure nobody else has this story? Because I just don't want to get out here, destroy my career, and then be in competition in this space to try and tell this story. But it's been an incredible journey. It's been a blessing. And honestly, if you're a real journalist, you can't beat this story. The story around vaccines and the cover up around the dangers that are going on with it. This involves the worst that, you know, the worst that all of the elements of American society and government have to offer now. You get to see the infiltration of your government by an industry like the pharmaceutical industry. It's the most powerful lobby in Washington. You see the buyout of media so that we're no longer getting news. What we're getting is propaganda. You see the destruction of real lives, destruction of people that are really being injured, the cover up of that, the humiliation of those people saying they're crazy. I mean, it just this in many ways, as a writer, as a journalist, this story just keeps on giving. And to be honest, the high wire, you know, people will see that we're stretching out into other ideas of, you know, digital central digital currency problems and food issues and energy. But it's so hard because there is still so much information pouring out every day, and COVID as a story and this vaccine push and the harms that it is now appears to be causing worldwide. It's just an incredible story. And, you know, that's what you dream for as a journalist, is to be a part of something that can actually make a difference in the world. And I think everyone that works on the high wire, we really feel that calling and that mission. And it's been really nothing but a blessing in many ways for someone that's interested in good investigations and getting to tell the truth.
So, well, thank you. And I love that. It's like they were pushing their narrative, but it seems that as a skilled producer, and if somebody really wants to get the heart of the truth, you reshape the narrative and you told the narrative in a way that maybe related a lot better to people. Because I think that when you put it in a way that you're not dictating to people and you're letting them decide, you're giving people an opportunity. And the thing I don't understand with vaccines is, why can't people just decide for themselves? And it seems like this forcing and pushing upon people. You see what's happening. What is your next prediction? Do you have a prediction? What's to come? What's the next big thing that humanity needs to brace for?
Well, I mean, what I've learned to do is take them for their word. You know, there's been a group of people. They were, when you were watching Bill Gates over the couple of years up till the pandemic and really event 201, these people don't spend the kinds of money that they're spending to play war games if they don't plan on going to war. And that's really what was happening there. And so the writing was on the wall. You have to understand that one of the big problems here is that the vaccine program is failing. And I don't mean failing because people aren't interested in it. The vaccines are all wearing off. We're seeing returns of diseases like measles and real problems with vaccine-resistant measles now. In some ways, what people don't know is the same problem that's being created by penicillin and antibiotics that were really teaching bacteria to become more and more deadly. And now we're hearing about MRSA and, you know, and CRE, just all these different gut bacterias and things that are becoming, you know, antibiotic resistant. In fact, we're looking at, and I was talking about this when I was working on CBS, the doctors, that we're looking at, in many ways, we may see the end of the antibiotic age, which is there was this flash in this moment where we had this great invention. But in the end now, there's just not good money to be made in antibiotics because they keep complaining that by the time they get the antibiotic onto the market through all of its testing, the bacteria they were focusing on has already mutated, as we're now aware of this variant concept, outside of the range of what the antibiotic can do. So we've accelerated the evolutional process of the natural experience of bacteria and viruses through pressure from drugs, from vaccines. What is just new to people is that this is a problem with vaccines too. I think a lot of people were aware that we're having this problem with antibiotics, the overuse of antibiotics on cows and herds and animals and food.
They're injecting them. They're injecting now.
Yeah. So we have that same problem with vaccines. And so a lot of that is what really is this come to Jesus moment, if you will. And I remember thinking, you know, when I first got involved in this vaccine issue, I remember people say that vaccines are the greatest invention of the 20th century. And I would say, no, actually penicillin is. I mean, or the real honest answer is it's probably the toilet and sewage. To be honest, we've eradicated more disease through just not drinking from the same river we're defecating in and not having, you know, excrement in the streets. A lot of that is a lot to do with our health. But I started realizing as I was investigating vaccines more and looking at this idea of antibiotics, and the question I pose to anyone now is, though we look at Louis Pasteur as this great hero that came up with the concept of antibiotics that truly effectively right there in the moment can, you know, clear you of a death-defying, you know, infection. But if that only lasts for 100 or let's say maybe 200 years at most, and then you find that you, and I thought, well, eventually antibiotics will have run their course and we'll be back to where we started. But the truth is we won't be back to where we started. Where we're going to be is in a world where we taught these bacteria to be far more deadly, far more effective at killing us. And then if we lose the tool that was protecting us, and was also what drove us there. I wonder if in history we will look back at Louis Pasteur and say, what a great hero. We could honestly say all he did was give us this blink of a moment where we were protected, but really you pressured, you know, the environment to a place where then we saw a massive casualty and death and we didn't know what to do with it. I mean, obviously that story is still writing out, but this is a part of when you look at these conversations, we're all locked into a very short time period, the existence of drugs, the existence of vaccines, and we think we're seeing the whole picture. But for instance, polio right now, they have polio running through the third world. The vaccine that we're using is causing polio outbreaks that are spreading. They just released a brand new polio vaccine to try and stop that. And it's just reported, I think, 2 weeks ago, that vaccine is now causing polio. So even though they try to attenuate the virus or control it, it seems to be coming back to life and then running rampant. And by the way, we are now finding polio in the sewage system in New York City and places. Jeez. And so these are the types of things where people want to think, oh, well, we've eradicated polio. We have not. These stories are these journeys and these historical stories are not over. That is why it is really detrimental that we live in this sort of science bias, you know, feedback loop, if you will, where all they want to talk about is the benefits. They don't want to talk about the fact that the vaccines are wearing off across the world. People are catching measles that have been vaccinated. People are getting polio. They were vaccinated. So this story is really, really, and I think COVID revealed a lot of it. It revealed that they will call something a vaccine that doesn't actually stop you from catching it. And so then you've got to ask yourself, is that really a vaccine? What is this? What are we a part of? So all of this is just the ongoing investigation and journey and research. And as you said, we were able to predict where things were going because we had from 2016 to, you know, 2020, so 4 solid years of investigation into how the vaccines were made, how they'd covered up the problems, how they'd faked the safety studies. None of them, not one of the vaccines we give our kids ever went through a proper safety trial, which can only be defined by a randomized control trial using a placebo. None of them used a placebo in their pre-licensure phase before they were put on the market. Exactly what we just watched with COVID in many ways, rushed onto the market. And so this was a story we already knew. We knew how the game was played. We knew all of their rules. So in many ways, you know, I'm a perfect weapon because not only have I done the most thorough investigation of the entire vaccine program ever done by someone that has just a wee bit of skepticism, I also worked on a medical talk show where I was trained by Merck and Pfizer. Wow. And to how you scare people into alignment, how you get them to worry about issues. And so I took, you know, it was a weird training ground I never expected to be in. And I always think that those are the types of things that have to do with fate. But they literally showed me how they play their battles, what weapons they use. And so I went and used all of those weapons in many ways to make Vax. And then the work that I've done is from someone that does understand their playbook from the inside. And I think we've been very effective. And we, in some ways, people come up and say, you know, were you psychic? No, we weren't psychic. We just knew exactly how they played this game.
Thank you. And you've been so thorough with your work. And I always believe, Dale, that one of the things I always took away from listening to your shows and still listen to take away some of your shows is you plant the seed and people, I think, ask the question to themselves afterwards, and it helps them kind of come to a perspective based on what you're seeing. You say, you know how this game is played. And you mentioned earlier that Highwire is going a little bit into other places, talking about central bank digital currencies. And I think that's completely relevant because that was going to be my next question. Okay, we look and we saw how an entire population was scared out of their minds. They were willing to put masks on their children for a long period of time because they were scared, because they were told that this was going to be the case. So problem, reaction, solution. They got scared. And the same people that they were behind it or let the problem get out of the way offered a convenient solution. So we see this thing, the central bank digital currency, which apparently is going to be a coin that's programmed, that's going to tell everywhere you going to tell where you are. They're going to prevent you from buying certain things. You're going to have a carbon rating. It's going to be like a social credit rating score like China. And apparently this is going to be enacted if we do have a financial collapse, which is, I don't know how the world can be sustained on what, at least in the US, $38 trillion, $31 trillion worth of debt. So maybe there's a collapse and they have a central bank digital currency. And that is apparently the end of all freedom based on what you are seeing, based on the trajectory, based on what you know about the elites and their plans. Is this something that could very well come to fruition? Or do you think that because there was resistance or a healthy resistance to those vaccine passports, because the world, for the most part, majority did not allow people to be blocked from shopping or be blocked from necessities because they didn't have a vaccine passport, because that failed, does that give you hope that this central bank digital currency will fail? Or do you believe that the fear will ultimately overcome people and enough people just get on that this is their dark fate?
You know, it's impossible. I'm not a fortune teller. I tend to approach my life with, I'm going to do what I can to make a difference, and how this all ends is in God's hands. And I really see it that way. I can only be responsible for my actions and what I do. I am very heartened by the amount of people that woke up through this COVID experience. I think that we now, where we were all alone, there are just so many podcasts. We've watched multiple hosts on Fox sort of pick up this mantle. So there's hope that, you know, we're starting to reach the mainstream. And I think when you look at the CBDCs, you know, this central digital currency, we already are seeing, I want to say, I think it's somewhere between 16 and 19 governors, I think, have all come together across America saying we will not allow this into our state. That's a really, really good sign. That means that we don't have to travel this really long, tenuous journey through being called conspiracy theorists. It means, I think, once you have politicians stating it on the news, it's really hard for them to couch it in this conspiracy space. They'll still try, but it won't be successful. So that means in many ways, we've already nipped this in the bud in some ways, which means we're not going to be on this long, precarious journey to what, you know, is this even real? I think we know it's real, but now we've all got to do that job that we learned to do through COVID, those of us who are involved, to wake up our friends and neighbors and say, we cannot look the other way on this. You got to be writing your representatives and say, please stop this. This is not the future. You know, we've been investigating this. As I said, we're doing more, you know, shows on this. I just found out that in the EU, that if you spend more than $1,000 cash at one time, if you pay more than $1,000 in cash, it's illegal. You can be arrested under some circumstances. I didn't even know that was the case. And one of the people telling us, that one of the people we work with that's on our team in Europe, is, you don't have that in America? Is like, no. I mean, I know if I move $10,000, like there's a report that's drawn up in my, you know, checking account or something. But as far as I know, in America, we don't currently have a limit to the amount of cash that can be spent. And all of this is around interviews. Some of their top politicians and banking people are saying, yes. I mean, and the question is will you control the money through the central digital currency? They say, well, of course, we'll try to, you know, it'll be minimal though. Well, anytime we give up control, that minimal gets out of control. And it's really, I would say this, that I think the vaccine issue, and those vaccine passports were sort of the tip of the spear. They really want that level of tracking system. So I think there's two things we've got to watch now, is how they want to track us and what ways they're going to try and track us. So I think you're seeing already discussions, and we knew this. We were talking about this on the show, you know, years ago, but it starts with the vaccine passport. But it's very quickly, they want to now move into the environment, that it's going to be carbon credit tracking, where your money and everything, you know, how much, what are you doing right now? Are you driving a car? How much energy are you using? Did you eat a steak? Do you know how much methane? All of this is going to be a part of a giant social credit score to be tracking you through apps on your phone and things like that. that obviously then you might as well have an ankle bracelet on. You might as well be stuck in your house and be being monitored everywhere you go, because that is what the government wants. They're telling you they want those level of controls. I think the CBDCs is the end game. If that, I mean, I think the moment you have that, when that comes into place where your money, they can decide how long it lasts. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine an expiration date on your money that can change? They talk about governments can say, look, we need an influx of money. You're going to have to go out and spend your money. It's not allowed to sit in an account, or it will lose its value, or it'll start, you know, decreasing in value as you're not using it. All of these things, or you can't spend it on something. You've used up your carbon credits. I know you're at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, but you're going to have to get a salad today because that steak puts you over your carbon credits. These are the types of things that people might laugh about, but it is literally being discussed in Davos. You can see it coming out of their mouths. They're talking about these things. If we lose, you know, our dollar that way, if we get down to a central digital currency that our government controls, and I think a lot of people are confused about this, you know, there's a lot of government interaction with banks, but they're not controlling our money. This is government-controlled money, meaning they're watching every red cent you're spending, where it's going. Look at what happened in Canada when they shut down PayPal and the money going to the people. Even people that just donated $100 to the truckers, they had their accounts, you know, locked up and shut down. That just shows you what they want. This is what they want. They want to be able to say, you're not allowed to think those thoughts. You're not allowed to put your money in those directions. The moment that happens, you are now a prisoner. You are a prisoner. And I think that there's no other way of looking at that.
I agree. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something I think is probably gonna be one of the bigger fights for humanity, probably the biggest fight. And going into that, one thing that's coming to mind is, remember, I think I'm pretty sure I learned about Matthias Desmond from your show, Matthias Desmond. The author, he had that talked about mass formation psychosis, and to give a recap of talking about how totalitarianism evolves throughout the masses, that you have like 10 or 15% that are completely committed to the lie, whatever the propaganda. You've got the 20 to 50% that kind of go along, and then you've got the people on the outskirts that are never going to buy with it. What I, from your perspective, if you look at mass formation psychosis in terms of COVID.
Let me correct it, because there's this really weird argument out there. Matthias Desmond talks about mass formation. And then there's, you know, mass psychosis. There's two different schools of thought on this. They're fairly similar, but when they get put together, for some reason, these guys get really uptight. So Matthias Desmond talks about mass formation. He doesn't add the word psychosis.
Okay, mass formation.
Mass formation, yeah.
Right, so we had these people during COVID that were all completely committed to anything the government was doing, and now you see these restrictions kind of going away, and people are not wearing masks all the time, so now you don't have vax passports, at least throughout the U.S. So I'm wondering, does that mass formation of all these people that got riled up, is that something that you think that the elites maybe are – kind of dropping the ball, and that they haven't kind of stirred that pot a little bit? Or is that mass formation of those people that are completely committed to all those lies, that they're going to, once they're going to merge, once they open up a whole new slew of new regulations, new restrictions, that we're going to see those same people that have been quiet all of a sudden emerge and be the loud voices and try to oppress everyone? I'm just curious what your perspective is.
Well, I mean, it's been a while since I've done that interview. So I mean, I wish I sort of had the bullet points on it, but let me just, for people watching this mass formation, and they probably listen to you, but to be clear for anyone listening for the first time, mass formation is really a mass event, a mass, you know, social experience that can be sort of tracked through Nazi Germany. All the times people have done atrocious things, and it requires a couple of things to be prevalent in society. If I remember correctly, and I probably won't nail this to the wall, but essentially, you have to have people that feel lonely, that they feel isolated, as you know, across your society, whatever that group is. Then they have to also have an internal anxiety that they can't quite put their finger on why they're anxious, and an internal anger or rage that they can't quite, figure out what's causing it. And once you have that in society, all you have to do is hand them a common enemy, if you will, or something that brings them all together to hate on something, but feel like they're doing something to save the world together, that then gets rid of that feeling of loneliness, to feel like they're part of something. It vents their rage and anger because now they know who to be angry with, and their anxiety goes away because now I'm a part of something and I have a purpose for living. Oh, and that was the other one, was lacking purpose in life. And so COVID did that for people. You know, it gave them, your enemy is the people that don't get vaccinated. You know, the problem that we all have to deal with is this virus. The cure is, you know, social distancing, masks, and ultimately everybody gets their vaccines. And anyone that doesn't do that, you're allowed to call them whatever name you want. Please report them, you know, as we did in Nazi Germany, report them to this helpline so that we can go and shut off their power and shut off their water. It was really an amazing moment. And I think for anybody that was even the slightest bit still awake, any question of how did Nazi Germany happen, I think, was wiped away. You're like, oh my God. You're like, oh my God, not only is it possible, it's amazing how quickly someone will turn in their neighbor if they feel like they're doing what's right, you know? And that sort of virtue signaling thing. Have we gotten past that just because this pandemic's gone? I don't think so. I mean, I think when you look around, you know, it seems to have relaxed a little bit. But when you talk to people, they're still feeling isolated. They're very worried about the economy and their future in it. And forget it if you talk about their kids. They're still tense. They're angry that they feel like they don't have control over their lives and something else does. So I think all of those elements are there. What we have to ask ourselves is, what is the next problem that they get us all to come together on that will sort of give up all reality, like basically be hypnotized, but join each other in attacking some group that's our enemy? You know, they could do it around the environment. I mean, they're clearly trying to make it like anybody that isn't buying an electric car wants to see everyone on the planet die and every animal die. I mean, it's really at an incredibly insane level. Every tornado is the guy who didn't buy an electric car's fault.
Right.
Those 12 deaths are on you. I mean, it's like, it's, you know, but it's happening. And you got to watch how the news reports on it, right? The news, think about it. Deadly rainstorm, you know, I mean, deadly precipitation. When did the word deadly and precipitation ever go together? And this is the problem. This is why they're going to lose in the end, is actually we're numb. The news has been at, you know, I always think of Spinal Tap, been just playing at 11 for so long. We're desensitized in many ways. So I think it's going to be difficult. I think you're going to have a boy that cried wolf problem. Certainly if you bring another virus or get behind another virus, whatever bring means, I'll be like, he's saying they're creating viruses. Watch my show and you'll know exactly what I'm saying. But I think it's going to be hard. I actually think we're in a stronger position. I think where you saw about 30% of the population really reject the vaccine.
Very few people got it for the kids.
Very few. Yeah. I think that the next push for something like that, unless something really changes, I think you're going to see half of this nation and probably the world say, oh, I'm not doing it again. So it's a tall order for them, but I am sure they're working on something. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's incredibly dramatic and terrifying in how it's portrayed.
Well, Del, thank you for your answer. I have an idea of what it could be. Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Stephen Greer by chance?
I know the name, but I wouldn't say that I'm familiar with the word.
Dr. Stephen Greer is the founder of the modern day UFO disclosure movement. He is a surgeon from North Carolina, and he's actually briefed three sitting presidents about what they know about UFOs. And one of the things he's been warning about for years is he said that we actually have the technology that some of these UFOs have, and they're going to stage a false flag thing, make it seem like we're being invaded. And he said that's going to be a big thing. So, I mean, he's been talking about that for a while, warning people about that. I'll send you some information about that. I hope it doesn't happen. But
that would work. You put people. A 3-mile UFO, you know, above, you know, Las Vegas, and a lot of people are going to panic. And again, you'd have a common enemy. I mean, it would fit all of those things. And then those people that don't believe in aliens become your enemy because you're not fighting the fight. I mean, all of that would work. Is that how it's going to work? You know, I don't know. And look, there's a lot of seeds right now you can look at. You look at all of the release of this UFO footage that's coming out. This isn't by accident. Your government, obviously, and the governments of the world obviously are priming us to accept this reality that there really are is something as UFOs. I mean, frankly, if you say that there isn't now, you're going against, you know,
mainstream.
Mainstream, which is whoever thought we'd be there. And then you got to ask yourself, why are we here?
Yeah, it's just really bizarre. It's just strange to see that it was only a year ago that the Pentagon admitted that, oh yeah, we have UFOs, and it didn't even make news, but just tell you how strange the news cycle was. Like, people didn't even blink about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious, during this whole pandemic and everything that was happening, I don't know, it was hard for our family because, you know, we didn't believe, and we didn't, you know, wear the mask, and it was hard. And we saw how many people, the anger and the threats. And did you go through that with with people and that you knew? And I'm just curious because they're people talking right now about, oh, let's have a national reconciliation, let's reconcile. And I'm really having a hard time reconciling with people that were threatening to have you taken away because they didn't wear a mask, because they didn't adhere to these things. And I think once somebody threatens you with violence, I feel like they can't be trusted. There's no walking back from that. So do you think a national reconciliation is ever possible? And I was also wondering at the same time, what are some of the things that you personally went through? I mean, was it hard for you during this period of time, especially speaking out as a level that you were speaking out? You weren't just some average person. You were a person that was probably the leading the biggest fight in the history of humanity for freedom at this point, along with so many others.
Look, I always hold out for reconciliation. We're all brothers and sisters on this earth together. But one thing that would have to happen before that's possible, I say it's like forgiveness. You know, first, you have to repent for what you've done. You have to recognize what the wrong that has been done. I don't know what we're reconciling if you don't know what we're reconciling. You know, I am not in a position to suddenly say I forgive everything when I am not hearing from the other side, our bad. You should have had your rights all the way through this. The lockdowns never worked. In fact, they've created far more disease and harm and suicides and alcoholism and abuse in every single study done around the world. Far more people dead because of the lockdowns than were ever possibly saved. And actually, the science shows didn't save anybody. Virus still got to everybody. Masking the same way. The vaccine is a disaster. So until I hear my government saying, you know, we made a mistake. We overplayed our hand. In some ways, we put assumptions in place of science. That has come up short. We lied to you about the fact that it would stop transmission. We told you that you'd be protecting your neighbor when now we know without a shadow of a doubt from the executive from Pfizer, Jeanine Smalley, who admitted they never even tested the product during the trials to see if it could stop transmission. I basically just dragged Neil deGrasse Tyson over the coals on my show just this last week over this very issue. You're propagating an idea that somehow this product helped me protect my neighbors. And I showed him all the proof. We now know they always knew it couldn't do that, wouldn't do that. And so under those circumstances, I am all about forgiveness as soon as someone walks up to me and tells me what I'm supposed to forgive them for.
That's really great.
I'm not going to just generally say, oh, I'm going to look the other way. That's stupid. I don't think that we should do that right now. There's still a lot of work to do. We still have our government pushing this vaccine on children, even when the WHO has come out against the need to give this to children any longer. You have great guys like the Surgeon General of Florida, Joseph Latipo, who has been very vocal on this, Ron DeSantis standing behind him on that, saying this is only dangerous for children, has absolutely no benefit. So while we're still in a place where our government is putting children in harm's way, literally murdering innocent children that are going to be getting that vaccine for no reason, I'm in no mood to forgive or have a reconciliation whatsoever. We need to, you know, I need to hear a penance. I need to hear from them the understanding of this mistake that has been made. And then we can learn, and then we can grow, and then we can all really come back together as a family.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Del, in the course of your career and what you've done and all the advocacy work that you've done, what have been two fundamental shifts in perspective, and why do those shifts happen for you?
Happen to me, like my shift in perspective?
Shift in perspective on life, shift in perspective on how you view the world. maybe two periods where you had a substantial growth period.
I can think of one that sort of jumps to mind, and that is, and it's something that I a lot of people in this movement argue with me about, but it's a real shift for me. Really was when Robert Kennedy Jr. was asked by Donald Trump at the very beginning of his presidency to go to the NIH and bring all of the issues with vaccine safety to the very people that are making the decisions. So there was Francis Collins and Tony Fauci was sitting right across from me and other about 10 other luminaries that are making up our vaccine policy in America. I had worked with Robert on really laying that out. We had a team of lawyers and scientists and doctors that got together for several weeks before and put together a PowerPoint. And what I will say is when we went to that meeting and, you know, what is done and the lies are so egregious around these vaccine programs, the amount of injuries that have taken place, the decline in childhood health is so incredible. I mean, we just very quickly, we've gone from America had about a 12.8% chronic illness rate in all of our children in the 1980s. Just back in the 1980s, about 4% of our children had a chronic illness. So that includes two categories, either a neurological disorder or an autoimmune disease, but something that they're going to suffer with their whole lives. When we gave the vaccine program, as it's increased, we've only watched that chronic illness rate increase to the last time it was calculated was 2012. And then it was determined that 54% of America's children have a chronic illness, an illness they will have the rest of their lives, either a neurological disorder or an autoimmune disease. From 12.8 to 54% just in a few decades is the sharpest, greatest decline in human health ever witnessed. And, you know, there's many reasons why I put vaccines at the center of that, but that's a different conversation. So I was angry about it. And I was going to talk to the scientists. We're going to address the very scientists that seemed to be wearing blindfolds on what they were doing. And what I came away with is I called my wife right after, you know, I got out of the meeting and I said, you know what, honey, these people really believe this stuff. They don't, like, for instance, when we asked them, why, you know, have you not done a placebo study of any of the childhood vaccines, or are they just being done in early phase trials that we don't see? And Tony Fauci admitted right there, we don't do placebo studies because it'd be unethical. And yes. Meaning like they have such a religious belief in this word vaccines, even though it has all the same dangerous chemicals and compounds and even adds viruses and bacteria, living organisms, to the mix that any drug would have. I mean, can you imagine if you saw a billboard that said drugs are safe and effective? I mean, no one on this planet would go past that billboard and not think to themselves, what do they mean by that? I mean, like, right. Every drug? I mean, even ones that come, how about the one that killed my grandma or the one that got discontinued? So it's a ridiculous statement. Yeah, we've accepted it for vaccines. But when I sat in that meeting, I said to my wife, every one of those people, except one, I believe has a deep and profound self-protective mechanism that isn't even conscious. They subconsciously avoid ever asking a question that would give them an answer that might reveal that the work they've done is actually injuring children. It's not that they're ignoring it. They don't even see it. They're blind to the injury that's out there. You can see it in the Neil deGrasse Tyson interview that I just did. He's a really good person. He means well. He is just literally blind to a group of people that he'll kind of admit is there, but it's just not in his life to look at it. And so that is where the one person, by the way, that I said was there that didn't think fit that was Tony Fauci, was sitting right across from me. At the moment, I was like, I didn't really know who the guy was. It was pre-COVID years, before 2017. I was like, this Tony Fauci guy, I think he's evil. I think he knows what's going on here, and somehow he's getting off on it. But the rest, I really don't feel that's the case. I haven't met Bill Gates in person. I have a sense that he thinks he's saving the world by blocking out the sun, by injecting everybody with chemicals, and this is the only way we survive. A lot of people argue with me, but that was sort of life-changing in that I stopped seeing people as sort of what I call the cartoon evil person. They're just here to do evil. Really, what I realized is they're human beings, and it helped me. I think it's an advantage to understand how I can get to them and how I can beat them. You have to know your enemy. And if you're making your enemy some sort of fake cartoon, you're not going to have enough to really be able to win that battle. So that's a big part of it. I don't see evil the same way now that I'm in it. I think that we are all capable of it. I think we all saw some version of ourselves we didn't like throughout COVID, whether we were angry with someone that got vaccinated or something, an inability to control that. Maybe even manipulate the situation around us. All of those things are slippery slopes that can take us into very dark places. So that's been a huge change. And then, you know, and obviously I'm the king of long answers. The other, you know, what was the other
big great thing? Answers? Great answers.
Yeah. I mean, I've learned about this is, you know, I've learned to really love human beings. And that's something that what this journey of vaccines has done for me. And it affected my politics. I grew up, I was a loudmouth, progressive, liberal Democrat, loved to argue Republicans anytime, any day of the week, would have it out. And I remember I talked to a friend of mine that was a libertarian just a couple months before I stumbled into this whole vaccine investigation. And you know, I liked a lot of libertarian values, I said, but it just comes up short. And there's certain things I was like, I think it's just overplayed and I just don't think it would work. And he said, mark my words, someday the Democrats are going to step on an issue you actually care about and you will realize how dangerous they are. And the vaccine issue, it has what I would say left me politically marooned. It really rocked me that, you know, in California fighting for, you know, just choice. The fact that I can say my body, my choice to a Democrat, that makes perfect sense if I'm talking about abortion to them. But if I'm talking about vaccines, it's like I'm the Antichrist. Like that was mind blowing to me. But what I want to get to is, and what has really been a shift for me, and back to my point, was I've had to reconcile what it meant to be a Democrat. Because when you first make this transition out of that sort of thinking, you know, the first thing I would say is, well, the party changed on me. It changed, you know, over the years. And that's what we all say as we sort of find ourselves disenfranchised. But as I look back at what it meant or how I was carrying that, there were things now that were always there, you know. And what was always there was this idea that human beings are too stupid to govern themselves. Therefore, that's why you need this massive government, as Republicans always called the nanny state. Mm-hmm. Well, it comes from this idea that people are too stupid to govern themselves. And then I think truly the darkest thought that is carried, and I can't obviously speak for all Democrats, but a lot of them, and I'm including myself, this idea that humans are a disease on the planet. I used to joke with my friends about how we spread like bacteria, and I wanted to make a cartoon how Mars is like, keep that stuff off of me as rockets are being sent out. I mean, it was really this idea that we are a disease. I still hear that in my friends and family members that are deeply ensconced in that thought system. And then I try to equate that to my spiritual upbringing, that I'm created in the image and likeness of God. Those two ideas couldn't be further apart from each other. How am I the image and likeness of God, but I'm a disease on the planet? And I think that that has really changed how I talk to people, how I address people, how I think about the population, how I even think of those I'm against. That I think have got this wrong. If I can't love them and appreciate them and recognize that as disenfranchised from reality as they may be, they're still a brother, they're still a sister, and I've got to, doesn't mean they're not wrong, and I'm going to do everything to change that. I can't let myself be filled with rage towards my own kind. And I think that that's been probably the biggest shift that this journey has given to me is, I love people. I love animals, too. I love the environment. I still consider myself an environmentalist, but I'm not going to enslave people around an idea. I think we can enroll people into better ideas. I think we all want to be able to eat that fish that comes out of our river. whether we're Republicans or Democrats, conservation. We want to be able to eat that deer. We don't want them poisoned. We don't want our kids to have asthma. We know if the air was cleaner, that that would be the case. You know, I'm really happy to be close to Robert Kennedy Jr. and the amazing decisions he's making with his life right now. I think people are going to see a different way that this is all discussed. I think there's a smarter way to talk about it in a way that we can all be united again. We've got to find, and I really think as a society and a population, not just in America, but around the world, we really need to make it, you know, I want to say sexy again, but we need to make our uniting, like talking about the things we agree on, being what makes a great conversation, not what we disagree on. Because this just focusing on disagreements, just asking politicians about what we know will piss off the other side or piss off this, it's tearing us apart and we're not going to survive it. I think we've got to look at ourselves in this moment, what we've been through, and say, man, we're all really good at being divided. And I don't care if you are vaccine hesitant, you're afraid of your friends that got the vaccine, the scientists that are against you, as afraid as they are of some virus that's out there. And so we're all suffering from a disease of separation. We really, really need to get back to loving each other, saying, okay, why don't we pick five things we're united on and that we agree on, we can do something about, and maybe just for an extra course, we'll take on one little issue maybe we disagree on. But let's make the majority of our conversations about what we agree on, because there is so much there. And the reason our governments, the reason the media wants us to focus on what divides us, because then they own us, then we're tuning in, we're angry, we're afraid, we're alone, and they can do anything to us that they want. Divided we fall, united we rise, and we prevail. It's time to unite.
That was so beautiful. And as far as your long answers go, when you give them like that, they're perfect. Mr. Del Bigtree, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Dell's organization is Informed Consent Action Network. ICanDecide.org is also the host of The High Wire. We'll post a link to both. Dell, thank you so much for everything that you've done, for all that you contribute for humanity. Your spirit of fighting and fighting us for freedom is wonderful and beautiful. And thank you for all that you do.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, everyone, that concludes today's edition of the Out of Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show. Special thanks to our unbelievable guest, and special thanks, as always, to our virtues, Miss Carrie O'Connor, Miss Constance Dallas, and our associate producer, Jenny Lamisa. To learn more about the Out of Limits of Inner Truth, please go to our website at outoflimitsradio.com. And till the next time we meet, my friends, I wish upon you an abundance of peace, love, and beers. Yay! Take good care, and thank you so much for listening.